Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online, thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out. Hi everyone, Aaron Noonan here again. Welcome to the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken, a world leader in engineered bearings and mechanical power transmission products and services. Alan Grice was in really good form in part one of our chat. In part two, he carries on the form. Some of the topics we'll cover: NASCAR racing. Keenly interested in asking him about his time racing at the Calder Park Thunderdome and at Charlotte in the United States. We talk about his couple of runs in the Le Mans 24 Hour, his time in politics, which he lasted nearly a decade, which the man, well, anyone who lasts nearly a decade in politics deserves a medal. His time in V8 Ute racing, or V8 Brute racing as it was known then. He also handles the National Motor Racing Museum Couch Racer questions, those questions that our listeners have sent in over previous weeks, and he also deals with the Motor Focus Top 10 Shootout. Here we go, time to buckle up. Let's get ready to start part two of Alan Grice on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Timken. We talked about 86, Grice. I wanted to talk too about Les Small, because you two made a great combo for many years, particularly the Roadways era, but before that he was with the Craven Mile team as well. Where did you two first come across one another? I guess you became, you were like-minded, and that's how you got together and spent so many years working together.
Yep, I'm just trying to think. Well, he worked for Gown Heindorf. I reckon I met him through Gown Heindorf. Because Norm Gown and Bruce Heindorf ran a speed shop, and they ran Brock for a while in a Gown Heindorf car.
That's right, yep.
And Les worked for them. And I'm sure that's where I met him. That's where we met each other. And I was sort of trying to bust out of my straps, but I knew I needed a mechanic engineer. Chris has just walked in. That sounds about right, doesn't it? Les met Les Small through Gown Heindorf. Yeah, she agreed.
It's good. It's good being an interview when your wife can help validate stories, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it? that's and then, as you say, like-minded, we got on very well. We're a good mates. Not to say we didn't have a blue from time to time, but we were good mates.
Some of the best combinations have blues, because I guess they can be open and honest with each other and then get on with it afterwards and move on like nothing really happened. He was with you with a fair bit of that NASCAR stuff that went on, and you did the racing in America but also in Australia as well. How did that whole NASCAR connection for you start? Was that you identifying it as, I should get among this, this looks like a bit of fun? Is it Bob Jane saying, hey, Gricey, you're my guy, come and let's go to America? How did that all come to be?
John Shepherd built the first five or eight cars, or 12, I don't know. But he built them as rolling chassis, and the team's got them at a reasonable price. It was an advertising thing to advertise Calder in this new type of racing, that he got Shepherd to build two complete cars and to take them to the World 600 at Charlotte. And he asked me and Graham Crosby, we'll take you and your wife and you'll be over there for a fortnight. So we went to a Buddy Baker school, actually, because you couldn't go straight into the World 600 without a NASCAR license. So we had to go to the Buddy Baker school and get endorsed by Buddy Baker to even be able to practice it for the World 600. And I qualified with Foster's backing, and I qualified for the race, and unfortunately Cross didn't. And it sort of broke his heart. I don't think he drove after that, but there it was.
Very different style of racing, mate. How did you adapt to it? Were you intimidated by it? What did you think about it? Because it was a whole new world that we were Australia Racing was getting into. We just didn't have a track like that and style of cars like that.
No, it was quite extraordinary that the speed with which you could turn into a corner. You know, we've got a motor racing road racing head on, and you got the head control, the eyes control the information to the head, and then the head controls the information to your right foot. And you, this turn one or turn three are coming up when you've got to turn into the, you've got to be so fast and turn into the corner, and you can't keep your bloody foot on the throttle. Your throttle looks up to your forehead and says, "Get back." I'm not going in there flat.
You are, yeah, the brain saying to the foot, you what? You're going to do what?
So you've got to do enough laps to get, I have to teach your brain that you'll still be alive in another 2 seconds time.
Was it a realistic, you qualified for the World 600, which these days I think it's called the Coke 600 from memory. It's the Memorial Day NASCAR race that's held the night that the Indy 500's on. So it's a really big deal, and you were the first Australian, probably the first non-American to turn up for.
No, there was a Canadian bloke.
Oh, he's close enough. He's North American. You know, don't ruin my story, Grice. Jeez. but you know, like it was one of those scenarios where. No one outside the Daytona 500 at the time, it was probably the biggest NASCAR race on the calendar. So, I mean, you're not just...
Well, the thing that you never hear about or you never read about is that the teams, there are so many teams in the United States, and there are teams that run professional NASCAR all year. There are other teams that try to qualify for 1, 2, 3, or 4 of their local races a year. And they're still full professional semi-trailer teams. So on about the Tuesday before the World 600, they start, I think, let's say they start 40. There might be 100 semi-trailers, trucks and transporters and truckloads of spare chassis and spare engines. From these professional teams from all over America arrive, and at the end of Tuesday, the slowest 20 go home. At the end of Wednesday, the slowest 10 go home. At the end of Thursday, the slowest 10 go home, and that leaves your field to then get into qualifying. I mean, and these are the trucks that go out the gate. They're the most immaculate things you've ever seen in your life, better than anything. Anything we've got in Australia, and they're told to go home on Tuesday or Wednesday. Mm. So how hard is it to get in the race?
Hand on heart, did you think you were honestly going to qualify when you turned up there for the first time?
The thing was, we went to this Buddy Baker driving school, and Crosby was 1 or 2 tenths quicker than me there with no pressure on. But once we got to this day by day trying to stay in the top 20 or whatever, he got more and more pressure and more and more pressure, and he started to go worse and worse. And I finished up being a second a lap quicker than him, whereas he was a couple of tenths quicker than me when there was no pressure on. You know, there's all that sort of thing comes into it. Yeah. Did I think I'd qualify? Yeah. Always thought I'd qualify, but I didn't know how in the name of Christ I was going to do it.
But you did. I think it was the 03 Foster's Oldsmobile. It couldn't have got more quintessential NASCAR American than a name and a sponsor, a colour. Of course, Foster's, you know, it was the 80s. I mean, it was Crocodile Dundee and Hoag's and Foster's and the America's Cup win. And, you were racing world touring cars, European stuff. There was that real world stuff going on, and so much.
Yeah, and
it was great.
Typical to cause the some American motor racing journalist dredged up the fact that I was the quickest rookie qualifier ever. I think I was the only one.
Hey, it doesn't matter if you're the only one. You are the one. You hold the record. That's a record. That's a record. Tell me, too, remember that the very first NASCAR race at Calder, early 88, was a big deal. They brought out some big-name drivers.
Yeah.
Neil Bonnett, a very young Michael Waltrip was in the field, who won the Daytona 500 a couple of times many years later. I think Johnny Rutherford might have been in the field. There were some big names. Bob Jones spent a lot of money on that one, but you ended up in hospital. Tell me about that big wreck that you had with a bunch of cars. You'd been motoring along pretty well, and then no brakes and a crash, and you were suddenly banged up pretty well.
Yeah, no brakes, and I got on the phone and said, I've got to come in. I've got little brake, and now I've got no brake. And Les said, well, just roll it around until there's a yellow, and at least that won't put us out of the race. Because you're out of on a track like Calder, if you come in under go conditions, you're pretty much out of it for the rest of the day. So I was rolling around waiting for the yellow, and when the yellow came out, I was in it.
Mm. It was a big shunt.
It was a big shunt, and I thought I'd broken something in my chest, because for about 3 days I couldn't keep anything down. But I'd broken nothing. It was just that the force of gravity throwing my chest against the six point belts probably. It just shocked a hole in my stomach and my body. I stopped so fast, I couldn't hold anything down. And I'm not prone to throwing up. You know, that's not my nature, not my metabolism. But I thought I must have broken something, but I didn't. It was just to show the force of the deceleration.
Was that the biggest crash of your career?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the biggest hit. And I broke nothing.
And did it put you off the NASCAR thing, or you just went, no, it's just a thing, I'll keep going?
Yeah, if you play football, you break your nose, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Was there ever an ambition? I know you did Charlotte a couple of times and backwards and forwards, but was there ever a plan? Was there ever, you know, there might be something to reveal here to our listeners. Was there ever a plot or a plan to get a full-time NASCAR team, or to maybe even take one of those Commodore NASCARs? Because remember that they panelled a NASCAR as a Commodore, and I think they did some Falcons as well, but to take one of them to America. Was there bigger and better plans in place to do it full-time or on a bigger scale?
Yes, but not that way, not the way you've suggested. I don't know how we fell upon RAHMOC, R-A-H-M-O-C, engineering, which was a NASCAR team, and they were made up of two. Ray was... Butch, what were their names? RAHMOC, anyway, two different blokes, was half their name each. And they were hired to be consultants to us alongside their own cars. And I think that's Neil Bonnett, I think, was running one of their cars.
I think he won that inaugural race in 88 at Calder in one of their cars, yeah.
That's correct, yeah. Well, we were working out of their workshop with their preparing the car. Like when the cars arrived and came out of the container, this good old guy looked at the cars because they were John Shepherd-built cars, and he said, "Boy, they're real, real fine-looking cars, but they ain't race cars." Because, you know, the spring pickup points were wrong and this was wrong. Anyway, they were hired to make them into race cars, and they did. And then they asked me to come back after we'd finished, and I think we broke a diff or something. I think we had a diff problem. Yeah. They contacted me and said they think they're entering another car. They had another sponsor by then. I think part of the deal was they'd run two cars at the World 600. So they rang and said, you know, you want to come out and drive one of our cars? I said, I want to come out and drive one of your cars. Sure, yeah. So they were going to pay me some money and pay for the airfare and all that sort of stuff. And I think that was from their new sponsor, but I didn't ask. And I came out and we went for a private test and running both cars. We had the radio on and I'm going around and I'm sort of trying to keep my nose clean and sneaking at it. And they came on and said, oh, great stuff. You've just done a XYZ of 41.6 or something or other, which was right on the pace. And I've sort of gone, bloody hell, you're kidding. I'm still getting my eye in here. I haven't really had a crack yet. So I've got to move myself forward and back in the seat and, get everything going because I'm going to have a crack now that I've done that time. When I did it easy, I'm going to have a crack now and watch this. And in doing that, wriggling around and moving harness and everything, I pulled the steer, pulled back on the steering wheel and it came straight off. That's when I had a shunt.
That'll do
and
it.
That was the end of my NASCAR career because I wrote the car off, and it's very unusual to do that. When I had the steering wheel in my hand, the car's only going to go one way because they're set up with positive camber and negative caster on the front left and negative camber and positive caster on the front right. So as soon as you take your hands off the steering wheel, it's going to turn left, right? That's what it did. And it just happened to turn left where they had a gate that used to slide open to let service vehicles across the track. So there was the whole inner wall. This was the only place where there was a protruding post, and that's where I went in.
Of all the places, that'd be right.
That's where I went in. So it was a good one. I couldn't hold anything down, as I said, for 2 or 3 days.
That one,
but didn't break anything. But
again, and another big shunt in a NASCAR, and you got away with it.
Yeah.
Oh, lucky, yeah. Lucky.
But I was absolutely convinced then and today that after the lap that I did, I was so in control of that lap, still taking everything in, still having peripheral senses and vision, that I reckon I could have gone another half to three quarters of a second quicker, which is a fair bit around a NASCAR track, which would have put me right there.
Mm.
But it would have, could have, didn't.
Yeah. was there ever a sniff from other teams who said, hey, would you ever consider moving to America and following that like Marcus Ambrose did, or did you just do your fly-in, fly-out thing and you were happy to do that?
No, well, there were strings attached to this one. They said, we've got another car. Would you like to come and drive it? You know, we'll pay you some dollars because we think you can go well because you know the track. Because it was Charlotte. And I'm sure there were strings attached to that. If we got, you know, qualified well or gone well or finished well or whatever, I'm sure there was a future there because they wouldn't do that for just a one-off or nothing.
Mm. Yeah.
They weren't that cashed up, you know?
Yeah. What could have been? What could have been?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
One of the other things that you're able to do in your time was a couple of goes at Le Mans, the 24-hour sports car race, once in a Porsche and once in the factory Nissan when you were driving their touring car with Wyn Percy. Was that the most imposing? I mean, NASCAR on a big oval when you've never done it's pretty imposing.
Yeah.
But was Le Mans the closest you would have ever been to being scared in a race car because of the sheer speeds and the no chicanes in those days? Was that eye-opening? What did you feel about the couple of goes you had there?
Yeah, well, it was, you had to comprehend the amount of grip they had with the downforce, and the faster they went with ground effects, the more grip they had. But I remember after the Nissan that Howard Marsden ran, it rained, and he came after me. We were just sitting around packing up at the end of the day. And he said, Alan, how would you regard your drive today compared with what you may have done in the past? And I said, oh, I don't know. I really don't know, Howard. I had a bit of a crack. And yeah, it was a shame that it stopped. He said, you probably don't realize, but in the wet, you were swapping fastest laps with the Rainmaster, Hans Stuck. I said, no, I didn't. So it took a fair bit to impress old Howard. He'd been around for a while. I think, Helen, I think this may have been your greatest drive.
you got to take credit whenever you get it from anyone.
Anyway.
It's a long way to come from Maitland to end up at Le Mans. Tell me about, I think you drove a Porsche the first time that was a privateer car that kept popping the wheels off.
Bloody Charles Ivey.
Yeah, I think SAS had got involved to help you out with some sponsorship and to get you into there. Then there was a few other Aussies. Perkins was there with Brock and a couple of Alan Jones and Vern Schuppen. So there was a real Australian, again, it was another one of those 80s things where the Aussies were having a crack at the world. Did it scare you? Did you find it imposing? Did you find it home? Did you think, wow, I've got to find a way to come back and do this again? What was your thoughts on the Le Mans experience?
That story about the kink, because there was no chicane then in those days, and that story about going flat through the kink with the ground because of the ground effects was something you just couldn't get your mind around. And I truly thought that these bombs that have been coming out to Bathurst, John Fitzpatrick and Derek Bell and Jonesy and Vern, I reckon they've all got together over a beer and said, let's set fucking Gricey up and tell him that the Mulsanne King's flat. I honestly thought that they were doing that because they were all being as helpful as possible. They see him in the toilet, you see him having a coffee or something. How you going, Gricey? Anything we can help you with? Oh, yeah, righto. And I was having some trouble I was having a bit of trouble with some one complex, and they go, how are you going to the kink? And I said, no, it's flat. No, I'd say, yeah, that's right, I was having trouble with the kink. Where do you break for the kink? No, it's flat. Okay. And John Fitzpatrick come up, hey, Gracie, how are you going with the track? I'm having trouble with the kink. Oh, it's flat. Like, these bastards have got together and they're going to G me up and tell me it's flat and then dismissing it. So I work myself up. And the thing was, when you go through flat, you don't lift the nose because you get off the throttle, you lift the nose. It changes the aerodynamics, changes the ground effects, and it's a bloody handful through the kink. But if you go flat, the nose stays down, the ground effects do their job, and you could go through there rolling the cigarette flat. But you've got to tell your brain that. You know, if I'm getting out of the throttle and nearly going off the road, well, I'm going to die if I go through there flat. That's the common sense, isn't it?
It's the same foot versus brain argument that you probably had a few years later in the NASCAR. It was doing the same thing.
Exactly. Oh,
the eyes are saying this is not going to happen. The foot says it has to happen, but the eyes are saying no.
Exactly happened. Exactly correct.
I loved that 80s era. I guess when you always hark back to the period when you were young, and for me, 80s was when I was growing up watching the sport. So I love that you and others, but you primarily, because you took on the world, the touring car stuff, the NASCAR stuff, Le Mans, Spa 24 Hour, all that sort of stuff, which was a real that stuff will never happen again. There'll be no one who can do that because of the way that motor racing has become. That's just how it's all evolved. Yeah. But I really love looking at that era. The politics for you when you became a Member of Parliament, 92, with you were the member for Broadwater up there in Queensland. Yeah. And that's kind of – once you did that, the racing – obviously you just didn't have as much time. So racing took a bit of a back seat, and I guess it was pretty hard to do just because you didn't have as much time.
Sure, exactly, yeah. You know, people ask me about that, and there's no doubt that the way that the job of work of a Member of Parliament is structured, if you want to have a bludge, you're in the perfect job. It's just the way it is. But if you want to have a crack, there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of background work to be done, a lot of homework to be done if you want to have a crack, because you can't afford to be wrong. So you've got to triple check everything. If you want to have a bludge, no problem.
Where did the aspiration to become a Member of Parliament come from? Was it because you'd cut your teeth in motor racing where it's very political? Was it a case of you wanted to make a difference in the state and in the country?
I've always had an interest. You know, even today, and since it first came out, I buy the Australian every day because it's the best broad spectrum news sheet in the country, in my view. So I've always kept up with it. And I still do today. Always had an interest. I was never a member of a political party until I started to get interest and realised that I had to be a member of a party to be elected to stand. So I joined the National Party just before they combined to the LNP. But I was always right wing. I thought Attila the Hun was a bit of a pinker.
Did anyone have to elbow you to do this and to run for it, or did you?
Yeah, they did. When I was sort of thinking I might have a bit more of a look at this, I had a couple of friends who were in the National Party, and I joined through them, and then became more interested through them. Yeah.
You're in Parliament for, I think, about 9 years back into the early
2000s. Three terms, yeah. That's correct.
Yep. What are you most proud of? What were the things that you were able to make happen, or that you pushed for, or that you fought for, that you look back on now and go, yep, I'm glad I did that, because I was there to make a difference and I got some stuff done.
Well, they're probably private battles I had, because if I thought our policy or our opinion of this new legislation was wrong, I'd stand up and I wouldn't just click my heels because that was a party decision. I'd stand up and say, no, this is all bullshit. I don't think you're right. And they go, what? I said, no, I think you're right. But the old policy advisors say this. I said, well, a member for Broadwater doesn't. I think it's bullshit. They wouldn't know what to say because you don't. Not supposed to do that. So if you want to get a bit of quiet in the room, introduce me. So, you know. I didn't toe the party line. I mostly did, because I mostly genuinely did. You know, I wasn't being obstropolous for the sake of it, but occasionally they'd get something wrong and I'd tell them. You're not supposed to do that.
What's got more politics? Politics or motor racing?
Oh, I think motor racing.
Yeah.
underlying politics.
We'll get back to the podcast in just a moment. But I wanted to quickly tell you about our good friends at Timken, a world leader in engineered bearings and mechanical power transmission products and services. Now, you might know their name and you might recognise their logo, but did you know that Timken bearings are used in the centrepiece of one of the most stunning stadiums in the world of sport? The $2 billion, yes, billion-dollar Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta features a retractable roof that is a work of incredible engineering. It features 8 triangular roof panels, or pedals as the designers call them, that slide open and close in the same way that a camera shutter does. Each pedal weighs almost 500 metric tons, and when the roof is closed, each pedal cantilevers over 60 metres from the outer edge of the stadium. Now, despite the weight, the size and the complexity of the design, the roof can be closed in just over 7 minutes and open in just over 8. With Timken's tapered roller bearings used to ensure each pedal moves smoothly. The stadium's home to the Atlanta Falcons NFL team and the Atlanta United Major League Soccer team, and in 2019, it hosted the crown jewel of American football, the Super Bowl. We'll bring you more cool facts about Timken in each episode of the V8 Sleuth podcast through the course of the year. Now, it's back to the podcast.
I guess, though, that when that ended, so I think 2001... Is that what meant that you could go do the V8 Ute racing thing, because you now had a bit more time and that you still had a yearning for doing a bit of racing?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, yeah.
There couldn't have been a better category that fit you and your style. V8 Utes, Gricey, quintessentially Australian. You had a Kubra sponsorship. That all made sense. Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. I remember I did an interview on television on one of the general sports shows. I was trying to think who it was with. And they said, they asked the normal question, you know, how do you find it with the lightweight ute, you know, with the back sliding around? I said, oh, no, we've got the dogs to fix that. And they said, what do you mean? So I got three blue heelers in the back, and when I want to turn left, I lean my head over to the left, and they all run over the left-hand side of the tray. And when I want to brake hard, I put my head back, and they go to the back of the tray to keep the tray down. And they all laugh and say, oh, yeah, that's funny. I said, there's only one problem. Yeah, what's that? I said, well, I got Dopey. Dopey's one of the three dogs. And every now and then he goes the wrong way and brings the field down. And they've all erupted.
Got to be a storyteller. Got to be a storyteller to get a bit of interview interest, don't you? The other thing that I wanted to briefly touch on with you is everyone will forget, but you did the first Bathurst 24-hour. You're in that Porsche GD3 that led. Everyone remembers the Monaro that won, and it's well-publicised, but your Porsche, and you at the wheel for a fair chunk of it, led more laps than the Monaro.
Yeah, that's right.
Was good enough to win, but didn't quite get there.
No, it was a third driver syndrome. The bloke that owned it, he was a working mechanic, and he was a good half a good driver too, and to make it work, he used to take, like I did when I went to Europe, used to take drivers on with money in a helmet, and that was the downfall of that car. The guy that came got in the car third. You know, because those things have all got records of what revs we used, and he was just all over the place and blew it up.
I remember he was very slow as well.
Yeah.
Very slow. And it was yourself, David Brabham, Darren Palmer, who was son of Ross Palmer, that was the guy putting up the money for the race with Procar. And the other guy's name, for those wondering, Manfred Urash, is the name that stuck in my memory bank from those years. That was him. And he was about 30, 40 seconds a lap slower. And not three or four, it was genuinely, if you looked up the records, to find the fastest lap of the race. So constantly trying to make up time after he'd been in the car. Good time for him to drive, safety car periods, because he couldn't get past or lose time. Gricey, I've got a bunch of questions here from our listeners. I'll start to whir through them. Our couch racer questions brought to you by the National Motor Racing Museum up at Mount Panorama, who, of course, got so many great cars and elements of the sport from over the years. We filmed with you, actually. Remember the Shannon's Legend series with Neil Crompton 4 or 5 years ago in the museum, the number 36 Roadways car, which is the 1982 100-mile-an-hour car underneath the skin from back in the day, is part of the displays up there. So I know it's been a weird year for everybody with border closures and things like that, but now that we're starting to get back to a bit of normality for those who were interstate or who couldn't go to the Bathurst 1000 this year or who could and couldn't get into the museum because it had to be closed, we'd encourage you to stop by and spend some money in that part of New South Wales, because it's a ripping place, and we can't wait to get back to Bathurst for car racing soon. So with thanks to the museum, our couch racer questions, I'll start with one here. It's from a bloke called Jack Perkins, and I've got a weird feeling he might be related to Larry, not sure. what's the best Les Small story that you can recall, he says. And I should preface that with that we're allowed to air as well.
Gee, you've narrowed the field with that last comment. I think there was a funny little instance where we were new into Europe, and we obviously had the Commodore. And then we had a weight that we had to make, and the car was built light, so we used to run ballast. And they pushed the car over to get ready to go on the scales, And Les and Tony carried the ballast. And they are both pretty strong blokes. Tony was a big, strong bloke. And they came over and put the lead down alongside the scales to see how much they had to put in it to make it its correct weight. And one of the scrutineers said, "Oh, look, can you just move that lead back?" And went over to pick up the top piece of lead. Now, Tony and Les have carried six of these over, went to pick up one of the slabs of lead and hurt his back and turned around and said, "I don't believe this. Will you please move the lead over to here?" And walked off to the ambulance. Pretty strong boys.
I was going to say, did he check the other five bits of lead that they weren't hollow?
No, we didn't do things like that. No, it does.
I got a weird, did he ever have, what was his best dummy spit? Did he ever have a really good one?
Didn't have the correct path. I think it was at the Nürburgring or somewhere like that to get into the paddock. And he gave the gate, a couple of people on the gate, education into Australian
diplomacy,
phaseology. I do remember that.
I could imagine it. I could imagine. It's probably phraseology that we can't repeat.
There's so many things that are end on in that era that's just different to prime apart.
There's another one here from another of our listeners who I deliberately avoided this topic because I saw this question was coming about the Craven Mild Corvair, the sports sedan that was such an innovative car. What was it like to drive? What are your memories of that car?
Well, it was a great credit to the bloke who designed it and half built it, and that was Tom Naylor. It wasn't Frank Gardner who claimed the credit for it. Frank only came on the scene because Tom couldn't afford a Formula 5000 engine. And Frank could, and he bought the concept from Tom and claimed it thereafter. But it was what was it like to drive? It was like a Formula 5000 to drive. It was a Formula 5000 with tin on it. It had Formula 5000 front suspension and brakes and steering. It had a transaxle and rear suspension, same as a Formula 5000. It was a great concept, and it was a great car to drive.
And it really did change sports sedan racing, didn't it? I mean, there's some cars in the history of categories that are game changers, and that was one of them because it turned it on its head.
It did. And, you know, you've got to remember that it was racing against one of our great car drivers, Jimmy Richards. Although he's a Kiwi, we claim him, in a very good car, in that Ford.
Oh, Mustang, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, that was a great package, and I didn't have a great deal of trouble in beating him because of the physical advantage I had with the car.
It's funny you should mention Jim, because we chatted to him on the podcast last year. And he told us the story about the time you two went to Mexico and raced in a thing called the Nations Cup, which we were wetting ourselves on the floor when he told us about how it all came together and the cars. But he did tell a story, and we need to validate this now that we've got you for a chat. He told the story that you'd approached him, said, "Look, there's this race thing on, there's a bit of money in it, we'll go and do it." I think he had to race under Team Australia for that, so we claimed him that weekend too.
We did.
Is it right that that these things just kept blowing up all the time and that you took him aside and said, "Right, first corner, get out of the way. I'm just going to come arrowing through. I'm going to jump the start and I'm just going to fire it on through and wipe a few of them out." Is that what happened?
Well, no, not quite. It was a bloody good story, though. I'm happy if it did happen.
What's the story from your perspective of how that all happened?
Well, I've got a sheet here that I found a lot of old rubbish that shows the grid. And Jim's last on the grid because going out the gate he blew a turbo, so he didn't get a lap. But I'm on pole, and I've got it somewhere. If you just bear with me for a second. Hello, got it.
Oh, you've got the proof. Here we go.
listen to the names who are in this qualifying lap. Well, as I said, I was on pole. Juan Manuel Fangio Jr. from Argentina, mm-hmm. Frank Bieler from Germany,
yep.
John Andretti from the USA, Oscar Manitou from Mexico, Giovanni Morbidelli from Italy,
yep.
Christian Fittipaldi Jr. from Brazil, Tom Bagley from the US, Derek Bell from Great Britain, Spain, France, Spain, Wilson Fittipaldi from Brazil, Philippe Gache from France, Japan, Russia, USSR, Mexico, Peter Bejay from Canada and Jim Richards from Australia, who was last because he said he didn't even get a lap. He turbo blew going out the gate.
So this what were the cars again? Some Chrysler thing that just kept blowing
Chrysler
turbo.
Chrysler Shadow, four cylinder turbo, horrible things. Horrible.
It's one of those weird and wacky race events that one off, never happened again, never happened before, and never had to go back.
Yeah, Vern Schuppen put me onto it. He had agreed to drive in it, and because he was an international driver in those days, as you know, and he was tasked with getting another Australian to be form the Australian team. Close to the money, his contract sports car drive called him up and said, "You've got to come and do some testing. We've just done this and done that." So he rang me and said, "How would you like to do this? Use a couple of grand, all expenses and a couple of grand in it, and you get another driver, and Bob's your uncle." And I put it all together in a week or so, and that was that.
Jim Richards became an Australian for the weekend again.
Jimmy did, yeah.
Well, he's lived here for that long. We can claim him. Because he's been so good and won stuff, we'll claim him. If he never won a cracker, he'd be a Kiwi forever who lives in Australia. But
no question.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Another one here, Gricey, and I'm giving this our Castrol question of the week, by the way, from a fella called Stephen Smith. I've got a feeling that this is a pseudonym. It's not his real name, but you'll probably figure it out why when I get to the question. He says, ask Gricey how it came about that he was asked to give Alan Moffat back the 1982 Sandown Endurance Trophy that he'd stored for 30 years. It's a bloody good story. Can you tell our listeners the story of the 1982 Sandown Winners' Trophy?
Sort of, I think. I think Moffat was pinged twice, not once but twice, for excessive speed in the pits. But I think it was in those days it wasn't done with a gun, you know, a gun to measure the actual speed of the vehicle. It was somebody's opinion, oh, well, that's going too fast. And on that basis, he was disqualified. But then when it came to proving it, they couldn't prove it. So he was reinstated. In the meantime, I'd been presented with the trophy. Like, it took some weeks probably for that to sort itself out. And I'd been declared, I was second, so I was declared the winner and given the trophy. And then I reported the trophy and others stolen in a burglary.
So someone broke into your house?
Yeah. I'm just trying to piece this together. But then some time after, I don't remember, it might have been weeks or months, I rediscovered the trophy. And it wasn't stolen. So it did get returned.
So some other ones did, that one did, and then eventually, what, 30 years later, one Alan gave a trophy to the other Alan.
That long?
Yeah. 1982, and this only happened, what, a couple of years ago?
I don't know. I don't know about that. I'm not sure about that.
interesting. That's our question of the week, thanks to Castrol, and I've given it because that race, the Castrol 400 at Sandown back in the day, because it used to be the Castrol Enduro for for many years, and you've had backing from Castrol over the years, so I'll get through the plug. They're more than just oil. They're liquid engineering, and Castrol provides the oils, the fluids, the lubricants for today and the future for every rider, every driver, and every industry. And you can follow Castrol on Facebook to stay across the latest in motorsport and exclusive comps and much, much more. A couple more questions. We're nearly there, Gricey. The pain's nearly over. Corey, this was one a lot of people asked about. How much fun and who had the idea to run that V8 Holden ute in the Bathurst 12-hour?
Very often these things occur in the bar of a pub.
It makes sense.
And a couple of, I forget the reason we were there, no doubt because there'd be some racing or testing going on. And having a beer with a couple of blokes, one of which was John Lindell, who was involved in motorsport on behalf of General Motors, unofficially, of course. And we're talking about that, and I half-heartedly said, I wonder if a V8 ute would qualify for that category. And after looking at it, John said, well, if it does and you want to run one, I've got one. I'll give it to you. And that's really the way it happened. It went on from there because power to weight, you know, with a 308 engine in them, they were pretty handy. And you could drive them in understeer because that'd make up in a way for having pretty poor brakes. So when I suggested to a Cooper, they said, oh, yeah, we're in.
Perfect sponsor.
And it all just fell. Well, they were a partial sponsor of mine because I went to them because I started wearing the hat before they became a sponsor. But it all sort of went together, didn't it?
Yeah, made sense.
Yeah, and it was as I said, if you drove it in understeer and pushed it up into the corner with lock on, and then bounced it across the curb to get the tail out. It was quite quick, and it saved the brakes. So there you go.
A lot of people still talk about the ute in the 12-hour, and, of course, the 12-hour's changed. I mean, it's a GT race now for exotic European cars, but at that time it was a proddy car race where if it was on the market, you could pretty much have a bash at it. And
exactly,
Of course, ute racing, well, the ute as a 12-hour car was this huge publicity. It got Holden so much PR because it was so different, but of course, ute racing later became the norm because it was a series on its own, and it was all pretty normal.
Yeah, but that interview that I was telling you about, where I was talking about the dogs running from side to side, that wasn't a motorsport interview. That was a general sport interview. That like it became main because it was a ute in a 12-hour race. It became a main story sport. Not motor racing sport. It wasn't narrow.
Yeah, it would have captured plenty of other people's attention who normally don't watch cars and racing and stuff like that.
Exactly.
Another one here from Andrew Cooper. This will be our last question. How did the whole Peter Jackson search for a champion program, the Peter Gazzard and Rick Bates won, Jason Barguana was a finalist, how did that all come together? You were right in the middle of all of that. What was the story behind the search for a champion program?
I'm just trying to think where the first spark came from for that. I think I'd read of something similar overseas. I got the original spark from someone. But I know it was easy to get going because straight up Peter Jackson wanted to be part of it. They knew of it. And Holden were the same. You know, if you can get it going, we'll give you cars. They don't give you cars to keep, but they lend you cars. Mm. So it wasn't difficult to get up and going because everybody thought it was such a great idea and, you know, we'd get a lot of press, which it did, and it produced some good drivers.
Yeah, I think the four in the final, I found a photo of this the other day because I was trying to remember who they all were. Rick Bates and Peter Gazzard were the winners and shared the car at Bathurst in the 1000. Yeah. A very young Jason Barguana was a finalist, and Brett Yulden was the other one who was in the final four. But you roped in, I remember, a bunch of other drivers of the period who were coaches and judges, and
They're all keen to do it.
In later years, though, we've seen a lot of different kind of search for a champion style competitions and things like that over the years, probably not to the same level or degree, and they all arrive with a bang and leave with a bang as well. Was that a case that was a one-time wonder, it went well, move on, or was there a hunger to do it further, or did you just go, it was a good thing, we'll move on now to the next thing?
Pretty much, yeah. I'm sure I could have done it again because, it did get a lot of press. But it was enough. It was pretty high intensity stuff.
Yeah, because this was a Grice deal. You ran this all and did it all and made it all happen.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, big project. Definitely. No, it's one that people remember about. So you did that program and that car ran in the same race that you won with Wynn Percy for the racing team. So 30 years ago this year, 1990. So, mate, before we go...
Well, it was a hell of a prize, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Win a prize to race in the Bathurst 1000, sign me up. Where do I enter? I reckon if you launch the same idea today, you'd get just as much interest and plenty of entries. Not sure if as many of them would be as talented and capable, but, definitely that's one way to grab interest. Mate, before we finish up, we do a thing called the Motor Focus Top 10 Shootout. It's thanks to our mates at Motor Focus, who are the gurus of model cars up in Queensland, motorfocus.com.au. They're at Unit 9, number 1, Stockwell Place in Archerfield in Queensland. Basically, it's a fancy form of word association. I drop a name or a thing, you give me the first word that comes into your head. Sound like a plan?
Oh, it sounds dangerous.
Don't be libelous, whatever you do, for crying out loud. Here we go. Alan Jones.
World champion.
Two words, but I'll let you have it. Wynn Percy.
Good bloke. That's two words too.
Yeah, put a hyphen, and then it's one word. That works. Bathurst.
Difficult.
Car we didn't get to talk about, Chev Monza.
As good a car as I've driven.
That's a fair statement. You've driven some cars in your time.
Yeah, it was a great thing. It'd point in, it'd power down, it'd do everything the car's supposed to do.
We like it. Bob Jane.
Yeah, a doer.
Yeah, that's a good word. I like that. Mike Raymond.
A describer.
I like it. Le Mans.
Yeah, great race.
NASCAR.
Fascinating.
Good word. I like it. Chev Corvair.
Great car.
And one more. Graham Bailey.
Good bloke.
I thought you were going to say the chicken man, but
no, that was two words.
Two words. You're using my own rules against me. How could this be happening? Mate, you survived the Motor Focus Top 10 Shootout. There's so many topics that we could talk about. We could go all day, but we are out of time. But again, thank you so much for your time, and hopefully one day down the track we can cover off some of those other topics, but I think we've got through a fair amount of stuff today. So, mate, for all the awesome racing memories you've given our listeners over the years, and thank you on behalf of everyone, and we hope to do it again when we come up with a few more topics down the track and we can pin you down and ask you some more questions that won't hurt too much, we promise.
No, look forward to it. You got the number?
We do. We'll ring it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Bryce. Okay. You're a good man.
Right on, it's all the best.
A big thank you to Alan Grice. Great chatting with him. We covered so much ground, but the truth is there's probably a pile more ground. We could do another 50 episodes with Grice, and we'd love to have a chance to have a chat with him again sometime soon. Before we go, don't forget, there's plenty of Gricey in our online store. You can get the full version, DVD, the full race telecast of both the 1986 and 1990 Bathurst 1000s that Gricey won. And, of course, he is a Holden hero, whether he thinks it or not. He is in our Racing the Lion book that celebrates the illustrated history of Holden in Australian motorsport. We've still got some copies left. Jump on the website bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au and grab yours now. Don't forget, subscribe to our newsletter via v8sleuth.com.au. That'll put you on our mailing list, so you'll get advice and knowledge of upcoming products. You'll get links to stories on our website. Keep you abreast of everything we're up to. And, of course, follow us on socials, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. There's always something that we're up to there. Anyway, that's Alan Grice, run and done on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Timken. We look forward to chatting to you for episode 83 next time.
Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online, thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.